It's the Moment of Opportunity edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week we have dangers for atheist graduates, anti-vax sleight of hand, Obama problems in 1967, and more interviews from the Imagine No Religion conference. Now let's begin episode 116.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. You know, this has been a really, really exciting week. You know, I don't know if some people have heard out there, but President Harper, sure, why not? He's kind of earned that title, has appointed some new senators who apparently ran for office and then didn't win, so he reappointed them back to the Senate, to which I am sure all of you out there will show your condemnation of his behavior, his snub of the electoral system, by doing exactly what you did when he committed the conflict. God, I had a great line there, and I blew it.
Episode is so ruined now. Way to go, Don.
Well, you know, speaking of having a great line and ruining it, Ethan, you know, you went to a lecture about evidence-based medicine and vaccination. And, well, how did that go?
Well, it was sort of, have you ever seen like a blender?
Contempt. That's it. Contempt.
Contempt. Sorry. Yes.
Blender. Let's talk about blenders.
A blender, and you put like food in the blender and you turn it on and it gets all like mashed up. That was sort of like me in this lecture. It wasn't fun. To put it bluntly, we mentioned this back in our Skeptical Highlights on episode 115. The talk was called Vaccination Science and Politics, What Should We Believe? And I attended this talk with some local skeptics, and we weren't sure what to expect. Maybe it would be good, maybe it would be bad, but, well, it was actually pretty bad. The event was hosted by the World Federalist Movement, which, if you look on their website, is a nonprofit membership-based group that advocates for world democratic governments.
Yes, and actually, we've mentioned their events in the past, and they come across as quite a, liberal in the small L sense of the word, sort of progressive, but I suspect that you weren't getting that vibe from this particular event.
No, it's kind of strange. I mean, the website sounds like, oh, these are, you know, level-headed, good-sounding folks. But at the actual talk, after about four different speakers came up to introduce themselves, I started to get a bit skeptical about their mandate. The sort of language they were using and the tone they were taking is very similar to people who talk about conspiracy theories about a new world order or, in an extreme sense, like the Illuminati or something. It was very kind of us versus them, kind of sinister tone to it that put me a little bit off. But, you know, keeping an open mind, I thought, okay, well, maybe the speaker will be very good. Now, I'm going to mispronounce her name, and it's not on purpose, it's because I can't pronounce names, but Lucija Tomvolok, I have no idea how to say that properly, but she is a member of Chris Shaw's lab here at UBC.
Ooh, Chris Shaw.
Yeah, now alert listeners will remember we had Dr. Shaw on our show to debate the H1N1 vaccine with Dr. Rob Tarswell. Unfortunately, that episode coincided with a technical error here at CITR, and we weren't able to podcast it. But for those who don't know, Shaw has often been referred to in a number of very dubious anti-vaccination articles in the Georgia Strait. And tonight's, or well, the speaker of that evening touched on all of Shaw's main points, namely aluminum in vaccines. Just because a scientist says something doesn't make it true, which she should have taken her own advice on that one. Why there are no animal tests on vaccines? What about sudden infant death after vaccines? And kind of a sort of the litany of anti-vax complaints about vaccines.
Well, to be fair, though, isn't her and Shaw actually doing research into the effect of aluminum on neurons as part of an Alzheimer research project?
That's right. But there's very little connection, I think, between aluminum and vaccines, other than there's like a tiny amount in as an adjuvant in a vaccine.
Well, you know, and the big analogy I keep thinking about, right, is like if you take a raw cell and you put some salt onto it, right, the cell will shrivel up and die because that's it's not the intended connection. Whereas if you eat salt or you have salt, it's relatively speaking good to you. It provides not in super high doses.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the sleight of hands that they're doing in this, right? I mean, their research may be valid, and I'm going to grant that they get research money for that from honest people, but often they pull this sleight of hand. I mean, you do come across a few other issues about it.
Yeah. So anytime, like, I or another skeptic in the audience raised a question, she would immediately say that she was going to address that exact claim and then proceed to do a Gish Gallop presenting studies and graphs that, quote, proved her point. Now, a Gish Gallop is where you kind of overwhelm your opponent with, quote unquote, evidence. And this case, what she would do is she would show a slide with the title of a study and then selectively quoting from its abstract, which is not evidence. That's anybody could do that with anything. If you just selectively quote enough, I'm sure you're going to get any kind of result, right?
An academic version of quote mining.
Exactly. And so she would kind of go on and on and on and that, and we'd say, well, wait, what about, you just sort of said that. She goes, oh, no, I'm going to address that in like five slides, so just stay quiet. And we kind of, this went on for a little while, and eventually the audience started to get a bit annoyed with us. They didn't like the fact that we were raising these questions, and one person loudly demanded that we, quote, declare our agenda. And then this was followed by sort of like everyone going, yeah, there's someone, we want to know what these people are up to. And someone said, who's funding you?
And Ethan, in a level-headed sort of way.
Well, no, not yet.
Oh, not yet.
It was a bit way off.
Cliffhanger.
Yeah, cliffhanger. So it really became apparent to us that we were in a conspiracy-laden crowd. Anytime someone mentioned, like, the World Health Organization, Paul Offit, or the FDA, you'd get this sort of audible sigh of content or contempt.
Contempt.
There we go. See, now I caught your thing.
Yep.
Yeah. It also kind of dawned on me how our presenter wasn't being very honest with her evidence here. She was doing this sort of Gish Gallop, but she was also did this really kind of bizarre thing where she showed a graph designed to show how vaccines weren't effective at saving lives. So what she did is she had the death rates of things like polio and measles. And then she would say, okay, here's where the vaccine was licensed and here's where it came into effect. And look at how the death rates have already been declining for years before the vaccine came out. What she did, though, was she showed the MMR vaccine instead of the measles vaccine. Now, MMR is measles, mumps, rubella. That came out years and years after the original measles vaccine. And so, of course, we put our hands up and said, wait a second, you're showing a new vaccine for a disease that was vaccinated against many years in the past. And she kind of, oh, well, it's the same thing, you know, really hand-wringing stuff. And we looked it up when the measles vaccine actually came out, which is exactly the point you saw the exponential decline in death rates. It was so dishonest. It was so silly. And again, the crowd did not appreciate this skepticism at all. At one point, I started talking about the World Health Organization, and I was I tried to say, okay, let me play devil's advocate for you here. I was trying to be reasonable, right? Let's say that the H1N1 was a bust, but what if it wasn't a bust? What if millions died? And everybody said, hold on a sec. Why didn't the World Health Organization get on our case? Why didn't they tell us about this? Why didn't they raise the red flags? Why didn't they do anything? You know, what are they going to say to the public who trust them to monitor health issues when they didn't do anything and this turned into a disaster? And before I could finish this sort of statement, a woman in the back yelled out, H1N1 was created in a lab and was genetically engineered. And I was kind of, I think my jaw sort of hit the floor at that point and I had to get it back up there. And I sort of said, but viruses evolve. This is exactly how viruses evolve. And at this point, the speaker, very reluctantly, I must point out, admitted that viruses do evolve, but that doesn't mean H1N1 wasn't made in a lab. which is, again, the level of academic dishonesty here is shocking. So at the end of the lecture, we were kind of ready to get out of there, but I wanted to talk to one of the organizers because he actually had to step up and say, hold on, folks, these gentlemen here are allowed to ask their questions, and being belligerent towards them is not going to be tolerated, which I give him, you know, applause for, although it is shocking that he actually had to say that at a forum like this. So I went over to him and I asked him afterwards, you know, does this happen often? And he goes, well, actually, usually we, you know, get pretty heated and occasionally we've had to call the police. And I'm like, don't you think it's a little strange to call an event a forum where police have to be called in because things get so belligerent? And he was like, well, I guess.
Well, no, but okay. So Ethan, I'm going to play devil's advocate here on you. On the one sense, I mean, you have to admire that these people care enough about a particular issue. Now, of course, we happen to think that they're wrong on some parts of this, but I mean, compared to a lot of other things that we tend to get really upset, and we see how the mass of people just lay down meekly and either accept it or they don't express their deep concern. On that one sense, I mean, yes, calling the police seems a tad overheated, but you can never deny that these people at least felt strongly about a particular belief. But of course, that doesn't always help reach the truth.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, passion is to be admired in some cases, but when your passion overwhelms your, I think, reason and rationality, you got a bit of a problem there. So at the end of the lecture, we're sort of milling about and getting ready to leave, and this woman, the woman who said, you know, H1N1 was a lab creation to me, and started sort of accosting me with, you know, how can you possibly believe this, and how can you possibly believe that? And at that point, I've had enough. So I just said to the woman, look, you're right, I'm a big farmer shill. I'm going to go drive my Ferrari now and leave. And I just sort of walked away, and she kind of, you know, walked off in a huff.
Editor's note, Ethan does not ride a Ferrari, and, well, judging by his clothes, does not have a lot of money.
Thank you. That was really important to mention that on the radio. But, you know, this is actually gives me a bit of a retrospect on sort of what I know about the anti-vaccine movement in general. And I want to share some of these observations with you. Anti-vaxxers typically rely on sort of a Gish Gallop method in debates. They try to overwhelm you with evidence, but, you know, like in this case, I said she just showed sort of study titles and then abstracts. But anti-vaxxers typically will take any study they can think of that has the word vaccine in it and just try to spin it as saying, oh, you know, vaccines cause autism, vaccines have adjuvants that cause neurological disorders. And when you go through these studies, you realize, you know, either it was so poorly designed that it's worthless, or it's not saying that at all, and you're just, you know, quote mining it to death to try to prove your point.
Do you think this is, some people have made a complaint that one of the downsides of the internet is that people can surf information instead of research information, that someone will put in, you know, vaccination, and they will look at the Google abstract for it, take some of the words out of that and use that as their, oh, see, it says, you know, cause kills children, and I don't need to actually read the report. I just need to take a quick glance at it, and that's all they do, and that we're getting this sort of, what's the word? Gish Gallop is a good one, but scanning intellect as opposed to research.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Another thing that I've noticed is that anti-vaxxers typically have some kind of like grudge story against drug companies or something. Maybe their funding got cut off or they couldn't get a grant. You know, in my experience with talking with doctors and scientists in the skeptical movement is there's kind of this, I don't know, quote, screw off mentality of sort of like young doctors going through medical school. They want to, you know, they want to fight the system. They want to fight the man. They want to, you know, go their own way. And then that kind of levels off when they get a bit older and sort of realize how the system actually works. And that was, again, very noticeable in our presenter. Another thing that I've noticed is that anti-vaxxers see conspiracies everywhere. The speaker listed a bunch of reasons why anti-vax studies don't get published. What she neglected to say is that every one of those reasons is a legitimate objection to a study in science, and that any scientist anywhere could have those exact same objections. Maybe, you know, they didn't get through peer review, maybe they didn't get whatever it is they needed. I'm sure if Rob was here, he could give us a whole reason why his studies have been rejected in the past. There's not a conspiracy. It's because the peer review process is perhaps too difficult, or perhaps it's a meat grinder, as they say. But there's a reason why it's supposed to be that way, because they want to keep bad science out of the journals.
Yeah, it's sort of like sitting there saying, you know, people aren't allowed driver's license because they have criteria like, you know, you have to be able to see, you have to know the rules of the road, and somehow stating those as though they were unreasonable.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, well, no. I mean, sure, there's a gray area where you could say maybe it can be unreasonable, but then you have to say what is unreasonable, because, again, being able to see and drive or being peer-reviewed is not in itself unreasonable.
Yeah.
You have to set the degree that you think it is.
The final thing that I did notice is that anti-vaxxers typically depend on a very vocal core of supporters who don't seem to shy away at sending death threats or using methods of intimidation to silence skepticism. And we've seen this before, not obviously at this particular lecture, but in the past, Dr. Paul Offit, who's an advocate for vaccines, has received numerous death threats. The Age of Autism group did that poster of Steve Novella eating babies, made some very misogynistic comments about some of the female skeptics. So it seems to be a sad sort of trend in the anti-vax community. Something that I noticed, and you know, here at Radio Free Thinker, we'll keep our eye out for more of these lectures and try to attend and voice a skeptical mindset.
And, you know, actually, I think maybe it's a good idea for us to do a segment in the future, depending on what our audience thinks, to do on the World Federalist group. You know, I mean, some of our listeners, I think, may be part of it or may be closely associated one way or another. And is this an aberration and they're just trying to support free speech and free expression and occasionally they get into the fringe groups, or is this part of their hardcore mentality? So if you have any thoughts or you know anything or any inside information, please let us know at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. We'd like to hear from you.
And we're right back after these commercial messages.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and The Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
And we're back here on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don, tell us about Obama and Israel.
Yes, well, there's a bit of furor over 1967. Recently, there's been an icy wind between Israel and the U.S. over comments made by President Obama. In a speech he made on May 19th, in a position he's reiterated several times over, Obama stated that the time was now for Israel and the Palestinians to come together and settle their differences, not new. But that they should at least be able to settle what constitutes the borders of the two states. Let's hear what Obama said in his Moment of Opportunity speech.
For decades, the conflict between Israelis and Arabs has cast a shadow over the region, with a larger cost to the Middle East, as it impedes partnerships that could bring greater security and prosperity and empowerment to ordinary people. Indeed, there are those who argue that with all the change and uncertainty in the region, it is simply not possible to move forward now. I disagree. At a time when the people of the Middle East and North Africa are casting off the burdens of the past, the drive for a lasting peace that ends the conflict and resolves all claims is more urgent than ever. For the Palestinians, efforts to delegitimize Israel will end in failure. And Palestinians will never realize their independence by denying the right of Israel to exist. As for Israel, the status quo is unsustainable, and Israel too must act boldly to advance a lasting peace. The dream of a Jewish and democratic state cannot be fulfilled with permanent occupation. Now, ultimately, it is up to the Israelis and Palestinians to take action. No peace can be imposed upon them. But endless delay won't make the problem go away. A lasting peace will involve two states for two peoples. So while the core issues of the conflict must be negotiated, the basis of those negotiations is clear: a viable Palestine, a secure Israel. We believe the borders of Israel and Palestine should be based on the 1967 lines with mutually agreed swaps, so that secure and recognized borders are established for both states. The Palestinian people must have the right to govern themselves and reach their full potential in a sovereign and contiguous state. As for security, Israel must be able to defend itself.
So that was an interesting thing. Now, to get a tone of how this was received, let's hear a clip of President Benjamin Netanyahu's response, at least to one point in the speech.
It's not going to happen. Everybody knows it's not going to happen. And I think it's time to tell the Palestinians forthrightly, it's not going to happen.
Now, it's not so much what he said specifically. It was the tone that I wanted you to get across. Because, you know, roughly the Israeli response to this is, you know, you're living in a fantasy world. But what was the issue Obama trying to raise? Well, essentially, it's the idea of the two-state solution. Now, first, there are some radicals on both sides, I think more Israeli now than Palestinians, but that's switched with time, that oppose this whole idea. Some believe that Israel has no right to existence. However, due to the actual existence and power of Israel, let's not forget it is the only nuclear power in the Middle East at the moment, it seems that only a very fringe, sort of crazy extreme group actually thinks they can get rid of Israel. On the other side, there are groups who believe in Greater Zion, holding that Israel should not only annex and, of course, ethnically cleanse the West Bank and Gaza in a humane manner, but they should also recapture the Sinai in order to restore the biblical borders of Israel. In reality, a growing number of Israelis do actually believe that, settlement in the West Bank should be increased and that the eventual goal will be annexation once it has become suitably Jewish, not for religious reasons, but for security and economic reasons. However, at the moment, both of these sort of one-staters are a minority. What Obama stated was sort of the same thing presidents and other world leaders have been saying for like decades now, that the borders between Israel and Palestine should be based on the pre-1967 war border. Of course, that being said, what's meant, you know, what are the problems with this sort of pre- and post-war border? Well, Jerusalem, one of the big ones. Prior to the 1967 war, East Jerusalem was part of the quote-unquote state of Palestine. However, during the war, Israel managed to capture all of Jerusalem and later annexed the unified city. Now, this is a big issue because both Israel and Palestine see Jerusalem as their capital. If the starting point of negotiations is the pre-1967 war boundary, then Jerusalem is open for negotiations, something Israel has stated that it will never do, something Palestinians insist upon. Palestinians don't understand why East Jerusalem cannot be the capital of Palestine while, quote-unquote, West Jerusalem can't be Israel's capital. Religion. Religion always at the root of all evil again. Okay, maybe I'm overstating in this case. One of the reasons that both sides have struggled over East Jerusalem in particular is because it is the old city. It is the location of the three most important or near most important religious sites for the Abrahamic religions. The Wailing Wall, which for the Jews is part of the Second Temple. The Dome of the Rock, which Muslims believe is where Muhammad ascended to heaven. And lastly, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where Christians believe Jesus was crucified. All of them have a very strong religious claim to this one small piece of turf. Irrespective of which line used to create the two states, there's a lot of resistance on the Israeli side. This is because of two direct issues and one indirect issues. Security. Although much of the fighting between Israel and Palestinians has been lopsided, it is still true that the Israelis feel a genuine fear of violence, be it suicide bombers, rocket attacks, or simply mobs, or as the Palestinians refer to it, the Intifada, which, again, is largely kids throwing stones. Sometimes it gets above that, but The first two, perhaps, are realities that they will always face. I mean, there are always going to be nuts out there. They're always going to be doing that kind of thing. But they all are sort of based on the idea of the conflict. As long as the conflict exists, that is sort of the fuel to the fire that keeps these things going. Security also has another huge issue with the settlers. Part of the issue is that right now in the West Bank, there are tons and tons of settlers, which again is where you get most of the mobs that come from. The mobs come not because they want to get rid of Israel, but because they are an occupied people and they are denied their own land within, quote unquote, their own state. And again, if you could settle the border issue, if only you could settle the border issue, a lot of these other secondary issues fall by the wayside. And as I just mentioned, the settlers. Of course, Israel cannot remove its occupying forces as long as Jewish settlements are in the West Bank. You will often hear Netanyahu state that Israel wants to have secure borders and that for security reasons it cannot go back to the 67 border. He doesn't mean, and he said explicitly in a speech he made just this morning, that it's not that he's worried the Palestinians will suddenly have tanks rolling over Tel Aviv, but it's the settlements in the West Bank that they are worried about as far as security goes. And these settlements, I mean, there is a history of it. I mean, they're in the Gaza Strip. They had Israeli settlements, and eventually the Israeli government said, you know, it was just too expensive to keep them going. But they were not as extensive as they have been in the West Bank. If you look at a map of Israeli settlements in the West Bank, it is a Swiss cheese of it, where actually almost the majority now of the West Bank is under settler control as opposed to Palestinian control. So, you know, if Israel were actually to use the 1967 line, and he had this idea of land swap, the Israel would be either giving up all of its settlements, which it can't really do for economic reasons, not for religious reasons, because where would it put the people? And secondly, again, there's just not the political will in Israel to do that sort of thing. Another issue, and this one's kind of indirect, but it keeps coming up, and Benjamin Netanyahu's little quote that I gave you there was in direct response to this, is the idea of right of return. Now this one, when Israel was created, there was a significant number of Jews and Arabs who were displaced from their sort of ancestral home. Most Jews immigrated to Israel more or less willingly, while the Arabs obviously weren't, because it was sort of their land. Also, most Palestinians who wish to return to their lost land, they kind of accept the fact that Israel exists. Again, it's kind of there, it's in your face, they can't get it. But they just want to go back to their little house or little block of land and say, okay, I'll become an Israeli citizen if that's what it takes. I just would like to go back to the place that I was born at. Whereas this is often misunderstood by the Israelis, somewhat indirectly, somewhat directly, as saying they want to get rid of the state of Israel. But Israel can't allow these people to go back. One, again, the land has been given to other people, and there's that whole issue. And second of all, Israel has always, always been fearful of the demographic time bomb. The Jewish people in Israel, relative to the Palestinians outside of Israel, but still in occupied land, is small. It's almost like they're either 50-50 now or 2-1, and it's expected to get much, much worse because Palestinians are having more babies than Israelis are, and Israel is quite literally worried that if it did allow this right of return principle to come back, it would no longer be a Jewish state, it would become a Palestinian state, and you'd actually have two Palestinian states. Now, of course, I think there's always been sort of the easy roundabout for this, is the idea of reparations, right? And I mean, so Israelis, Palestinians get the moral right to say, I have the right to return, and please apologize for having taken my land, kind of like what we did with our own aboriginals. But secondly, pony up some cash. And actually, I don't think Israel should be the one who should pony up the cash. I think actually the Western powers that actually sort of created this artificial state of Israel in the first place, largely out of war guilt from the Holocaust.
Well, also the British.
That's part of the Western allies.
I know, but they were the ones who controlled that area of land before Israel. And
yeah, no, we are on the same page, Ian.
Yeah.
So, David Cameron, write a check. So again, you know, you will hear this right of return as something that's, you know, we can never go back to the pre-67 border because Israel will cease to exist. And it's, again, political jockeying. Although it should be noted that the Palestinian Palestine was not created in 67 or 56 or 48, not because of the Israelis, right? I mean, the Israelis have always had an angst there. But the state of Palestine has never actually been constituted because of Jordan and Egypt. Because when the 48 war occurred to try and prevent the creation of Israel, they just sort of stayed. And actually, the West Bank wasn't taken from Palestine. It was taken from Jordan. Gaza Strip was taken from Egypt. And ironically enough, the reason why there has been no Palestinian state until 67 was Arabian issue. After 67, it's been an Israeli issue, which is, I think, something people should keep in mind. Now, lastly, why did Obama choose this particular moment to make the speech? Well, first, there's not much new in the speech that hasn't been said before. If you look online, George W. Bush, among others, have said almost the identical thing during their presidency. It is essentially the same thing that was said in the Oslo Accord in 1993, the Camp David Summit in 2007. Secondly, it was a good time because of the Arab Spring, which has seen a great apparent growth of freedom and secular democracy. However, this might not be as good as you think. Israel, although perhaps morally opposed to Middle Eastern dictatorships, had pretty much learned to live with them, and it provided them with a large degree of dependability and security. They're really getting concerned that this new flow of freedom and democracy and open elections might actually have a long-term swing against the interests of Israel. However, the biggest impetus for this moment of opportunity is the expected vote in September by the UN General Assembly on Palestinian statehood. Palestine is planned to be recognized for the first time as the state of Palestine by the UN General Assembly. And the U.S., no one has a veto over that, so they can't really stop it. If it does, this is essentially will put Israel in a very weaker moral ground on it, if that's possible in this particular instance. At the negotiating table, Israel will be sitting there sort of with a weaker hand. And of course, under international law, a real state, a recognized state, has very different routes, powers than occupied land. Mm-hmm. It remains to be seen how this opportunity will play out, but it cannot be denied that it does set a fire under Israeli government. And as I mentioned today, I was listening to Benjamin Netanyahu give a speech where he quite forcefully just said, you know, Palestine will exist, maybe, and if it does, it will be by our goodwill and how we want it to be, and it will be much, much, much smaller. Some people say as much as 50% smaller than what the 67 line is. And who knows?
Well, we'll have to stay tuned for these exciting developments. Stay tuned on Radio Free Thinker, of course. Coming up next, we have interviews with Christopher DiCarlo and Nate Phelps right after this commercial break.
Let me have one of those porno magazines, large box of condoms, a bottle of Old Harper, a couple of those panty shields, and some illegal fireworks, and one of those disposable enemas. Make it two.
To learn more about the diverse array of programming on CITR 101.9 FM, why not visit CITR.ca?
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
Connected to each other biologically, to the earth chemically, to the rest of the universe.
Joining us now on Radio Freethinker is Christopher DiCarlo, a philosopher, advisor to CFI Canada, as well as promoter of science and evolution. And now you can add another caveat to your impressive resume, guest on Radio Freethinker at long last. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you very much.
So how are you enjoying Kamloops?
Oh, I love Kamloops. It's a great town.
You've been here through this area before.
Yeah.
You did your Rural African Talk.
Yeah, Kelowna last year in the summer. And I'll be back again this summer to promote the book.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So you're a traveling lecturer. You give talks all over the world. What motivates you to go to all these different places, taking time away from your research? Why do it?
I think the message, first of all, is very important. We have to make sure we keep discussing these various ideas and principles and whatnot, keep the conversation going, as it were. The people, I think, is the main reason. Mm-hmm. I'm very interested in the types of people I meet and to see what kind of diverse backgrounds they've come from. And I like their stories. So many of these people, perhaps yourself included, were maybe raised in a religious household and have basically come to realize that secular or humanistic values seem fairly important in and of themselves, that there doesn't really need to be a personal god or a theistic type of entity behind them to make them, you know, work or functional, that mm-hmm. sort of thing.
And you've had a, I guess I can say, checkered past teaching evolution.
Mm-hmm.
You were involved in a controversy when you taught evolution in a university. Could you tell us a bit about that controversy and how it arose? And
sure, yeah. It was back in 2005. I was teaching in southern Ontario at a fairly well-known university. If you want to know the university, you can just simply Google "We Are All African" and you'll find out which university that is. But essentially, it was a critical thinking class. There were 93 students in the class, and I was talking about the relations of natural systems, the idea that one of the best ways science understands how humans function within the world is to understand the various systems that act as constraints upon them. And I said one of the most interesting inferences from this understanding of ourselves and whatnot is that all ancestry basically leads back to Africa. And in that case, it's safe to say we are all African. Well, one student took issue with this and said, how do you know that? Which, of course, is a great question, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, based on the evidence we now have, it's more responsible to infer that all human lineage came from Africa rather than elsewhere in the world. But she was an Aboriginal student and said, you know, my people aren't going to agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
To which I thought, sure, yes, of course. I can understand creation myths and how strong those are within a native tradition and that sort of thing. And she said, well, what would you say to my people? And I said, regarding we are all African? And she said, yes. Well, I would say they're wrong, that we can't both be right here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, science has met headlong with, you know, mythological beliefs, but I said, you know, based on your various beliefs, could you bring some elders into the class to discuss some of your band and your past Six Nations beliefs with creation? I'll bring in some scientists. And we'll use this as a forum of dialogue to show why we have evolved differently to have these various narratives or worldviews. And the class was very much interested in this. She wasn't. So she, along with two fundamentalist Christians, approached the dean and complained that essentially I was teaching things that went against their most heartfelt beliefs. I was called in. I was reprimanded. I received an official letter by courier to knock it off, or else, essentially. I was up for an appointment for a tenure-track position, and the position suddenly didn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, along with the union, we went to arbitration. We fought it. We won. There was a small settlement, but, I mean, I was still out of a job.
Yeah. I mean, you're a university professor,
mm-hmm.
and you're in a better position to fight this, but, I mean, it does give you pause when you think about all the high school teachers,
mm-hmm.
elementary school teachers,
oh, yes.
who aren't in a position to fight this.
Right.
Could you maybe give them any advice on how to deal with this sort of thing?
I suppose we're going to have to pull the semantic card.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought it would never have to come to this.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to have to get Socratic.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're going to play dirty, mm-hmm. as I mentioned in my book. Play fair as much as possible until you're up against somebody who just doesn't give a damn about playing fairly mm-hmm. and decide they're going to try to hurt you right. in that way. Then what you do is you just pull the semantic card, and high school teachers can talk in terms of conditionals, mm-hmm. which then makes everything safe.
In my opinion,
it has been reported that some people believe mm-hmm. there are scientists who claim that, and if they voice it that way, then they don't have to say they themselves believe it.
Right.
This is one of the things that bothered me about university, where coy philosophy professors would say, "Well, there are some schools of thought that maintain this, and some perhaps believe," and they were so coy and aloof. Some students would even say, "Okay, professor, what do you think?" "Well, we're not here to discuss that." Well, no human is without bias. Mm-hmm. No human is without beliefs. Mm-hmm. And regardless of what the professor thinks, a good argument is a good argument.
Right.
And that's what you should be, you know, evaluated upon. And so, you know, in my estimation, if it's going to come to, you know, that dirty kind of nasty aspect of higher education where teachers' livelihoods are at stake, place it in the form of a conditional.
Right. And has this given you any perspective on perhaps how to reach out to the sort of non-Christian, non-Abrahamic religions who have objections to evolution?
Ah, for example?
For the Aboriginal peoples.
On my tour last year, we went through Saskatchewan, mm-hmm. and we were in Saskatoon, and we went to a reservation and a museum, actually, for the Plains Indians, mm-hmm. where the buffalo were forced off cliffs. Like, this was a classic hunting technique.
Right.
And one of the curators of the museum was bringing out archaic tools and weapons and whatnot for us to see. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful.
Right.
And I was giving the We Are All African talk that night in Saskatoon. And I said, "How did your people get here in the first place?" And she said, "Oh, there are many stories." And I said, "I bet there are. How do you think they all got here?" "Well," and then she went into a number of different types of creation ideas, you know. And I said, "But aren't we related? Like, didn't we all come from, say, Africa, you know, maybe 60 to 100,000 years ago, and then we moved around the world, and then your immediate ancestors managed to come through what is now Siberia, across the Bering Strait, so on and so forth, and others came across an ice bridge from Europe to North America. And then when the last ice age retreated and then North and South America were continent-locked by two oceans, it separated us for tens of thousands of years, and then eventually my ancestors figured out a way to get across the ocean, and the rest is history, as they say." She said, "Well, yes, that's another story." And I said, "But is it just another story, or is it closer to what actually really happened?" "Well, we may never know." And I said, "I'm not willing to go there." So I still have trouble with the warm and fuzzy, politically correct, "Well, let's all just kind of get along and share in a kind of a, you know, a group hug sort of thing." I don't wish ever to offend anyone mm-hmm. because of what they believe.
Right.
But, you know, it's as PZ said last night, right? It's the ideas that a person has that you take issue with. Mm-hmm. And it's, I suppose, when a person puts forward ideas and the basis for those ideas are simply based on, well, this is the way it's always been, what's known as the genetic fallacy. Well, it's been this way for so long, it has to be true. Mm-hmm. Or that is the way it has been handed down from generations to generations. That is how it's written in this book. That is what the revealed word of God or whatever happens to say. Whatever. Then we're on different playing fields here. And the only way to coordinate that, to get people talking properly, is to introduce something that's going to level that playing field. Mm-hmm. And what that is essentially the universality that comes with scientific inquiry. Mm-hmm. Because it's one of the few systems of knowledge we have that is inherently self-correcting. It admits when it's egregiously wrong. Whoa, continental drift. We thought that was a joke. Ah, we were wrong. Ah, right. Ah, ether. Yeah. No, it doesn't really exist. Got that one wrong. And so we do learn more and more about the natural world in right. this way. So I suppose, Ethan, to best address your question would be to say, to develop a system of diplomacy that is going to be a no-holes-barred approach, but at the same time recognize why it is some of these people will have these beliefs and be so tenacious in maintaining them, something I call mimetic equilibrium. They don't want a disruption to the way things, you know, to the status quo, to the way things have always been done.
Right. Well, that leads me to my next question. Mm-hmm. Your new book, How to Become a Really Good Pain in the Ass, A Critical Thinker's Guide to Asking the Right Questions, mm-hmm. all about asking the right questions. Mm-hmm. Does your book, I guess, advance a more confrontational approach, or is it more about trying to find common ground and say, you know, well, we're both skeptical of Bigfoot, right?
Right.
So what method do you think your book advocates?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's written in three parts, and it can be read in three parts, or it can be read in two, or it can be read entirely. And in part A, it deals with the ABCs, DZs, and Fs of critical thinking, right? A is for argument, B is for bias, C is for context, D is for diagram, E is for evidence, F is for fallacies. And these are really the nuts and bolts of critical thinking. So anybody who reads this will be, you know, more empowered with the tools that will allow them to discuss their ideas, whatever they may happen to be, more effectively and more clearly. So we can be on, hopefully, a more level playing field when we're at least discussing ideas. Mm-hmm. Fine. Part two looks at Socrates and the ancient skeptics and the methods that they developed 2,500 years ago and past then in terms of the Socratic method. So you disagree with somebody. Okay, fine. The Socratic method is a way of dialoguing with somebody you disagree with without being in-your-face confrontational. It's more, okay, interesting. You believe that this evil lord Xenu did what? Mm-hmm. And flew people on things that look like planes that were, you know, what was it, DC-8s or DC-10s?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
And put them in volcanoes and blew the volcanoes up with hydrogen bombs. Fascinating. Tell me more about this. And through the Socratic method, you get the person engaged. Mm-hmm. And then as they talk, you use the tools from part one, the A, B, C, D, E, and Fs of critical thinking, to demonstrate to them, but isn't that a contradiction? Isn't that inconsistent? Aren't you committing the fallacy of ad hominem or whatever? And so hopefully you walk the person through it. And Socrates was so good at this.
Right.
And then the ancient skeptics were wonderful at developing what are called modes of thought or modes of reasoning, where anytime anybody makes a claim to absolute truth, they just had a variety of their bag of tricks, so to speak, to say, really? You think you have absolute truth? This is wonderful, right? So that's part two. And then part three deals with what I call the big five. And these are the five questions, I think, that have really gotten this world into the shape it's in today and the way in which we answer them. And that's, you know, what is the extent of my knowledge? Why am I here? What am I? How should I behave? And what is to come of me? And when you think about it, the way people answer those questions tells you an awful lot about them. The way they answer them trickles down and affects how they feel about abortion, same-sex marriage, euthanasia, loss, you know, health, all that kind of stuff. So in terms of finding out how people answer these questions, they tend to answer them in a variety of ways. But the most polar ways they answer them is naturalistically and supernaturalistically. So you can answer, why am I here, naturally. You're here because of an incredible series of accidents that led up to the possibility that was just right for you to have evolved to be, you know, having this conversation that you and I are now having. Why am I here supernaturally? God wanted me to be here. Well, which God? Well, this God, and how did he want you to do it? And then they'll go on and on and on and on to describe this. And so what I do in the book is I answer the questions, the big five, from a purely natural way of answering them and a purely supernatural way of answering them, and then basically just put it out there and say, which of these do you think, based on what, you know, preceded it in the book, makes more sense to you? Mm-hmm. So I don't necessarily take sides, although of course you know I do. It is just there as a kind of a handy book for people to have, because let's face it, these, you know, when I was a kid, my mother said, just don't discuss issues of God and morality and stuff like that, right? Religion, sex, and politics, don't discuss these. Mixed company. Well, but that's what makes the world interesting, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Those are the things we should be discussing. It's when we don't talk about this stuff, the elephants in the room, and nasty things are happening, and we're just looking at our feet and just kind of sideways glances wondering, should somebody do something? Well, we should do something. So this book is a way, I hope, that helps to further the conversation about these very important matters.
Excellent. Well, Chris, thanks for joining us on Radio Free Thinker, and please stop by again in the future.
I will. I'll probably see you guys in July.
Excellent. Looking forward to it.
Me too.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hi, and as a special treat, Wiener is not going to be on a regular scheduled time, so we're going to do a little extended version of Radio Free Thinker, and we're going to continue on with our interview with
Nate Phelps.
Nate Phelps, and listen now.
Joining us now on Radio Free Thinker is Nate Phelps. Nate is the executive director of CFI Calgary. Nate, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So many listeners are already familiar with your story, your family, and your background. But for those who aren't, can you tell us a bit about your amazing story?
Well, yeah. My father's Fred Phelps. He's the head of the Westboro Baptist Church in Kansas. That's the organization that has developed a national reputation, international reputation for picketing with their signs, God Hates Fags. They picket at funerals of soldiers and other high-visibility people, trying to get this message out that the world is doomed for embracing the idea that gays should have equality in our societies.
What's it like growing up with that kind of hate and bigotry?
Well, it's an interesting dynamic because when you're growing up with it, you don't see it as such.
Right. I mean,
it's much of my understanding of what that was all about came later in my life. But the environment itself was extremely violent, you know, physically, as well as there was a lot of intense indoctrination of this very extreme Calvinistic theology that we were subjected to on a constant basis from the time from the day we were born, we were sitting in the pews listening to that. And, you know, we were taught to have this aggression, this attitude of disdain and disrespect for those outside of our system because we believed that we were the chosen ones, or we were taught that. And we were to defend that kind of ideology. And if we weren't aggressive enough, you know, then there would be consequences. So we learned early on that we needed to be like our father and how we treated other people, how we dealt with the world at large. So.
And what eventually motivated you to run away from that?
Yeah, that's a very complex question. I mean, the reality was that I was constantly at odds with my father, as much as one could be in that kind of environment, because you know the consequences of any kind of defiance were severe. You know, there were many times when the question came up from not only my father but from some of the other siblings, was I crazy because I just would not submit to his will as much as he wanted me to. So there was that almost from, you know, as early as I can remember. And as I grew older, you know, I watched my father and I recognized that his ideas of how to treat other people just was inconsistent with my whole notion of how the world should be. And, you know, I believed what he was teaching us because what else was there to believe? But there was always questions coming up in my mind about that, as much because, you know, I was afraid that if he was right, I was in trouble, but also because oftentimes it just didn't make sense. You know, I would look at it as if we were these unique people that, you know, if we were the standard of goodness in the world, there should be evidence for that, and there just was none.
And when you eventually left, how long were you able to, did it take you to separate yourself from the anger and the fear and the prejudice that you'd been taught?
Who said I have? No, I mean, it's an ongoing process. The religion I held on to for years, I had, you know, I mean, there's social, there's the cultural issues surrounding it. When my kids were born, actually, I deliberately got involved in a church. You know, I went through counseling. I had two or three different bouts with counselors trying to deal with the emotional issues and the anger and some of the theological questions I went to counseling for. It's a process. You know, a little bit at a time, stuff gets worked out in your mind, and you move past some new element. A lot of the issues you don't even know that you have, and then they come up at some point in your life, and you deal with them.
Mm-hmm. And at what point did you become an atheist?
Again, tough to pinpoint. I was asking questions. I was starting to doubt. It was a process. I refer to September 11th as kind of a coming out moment for me, because that was when I suddenly realized that there it was dangerous to hold on to these ideas that we could explain our world and that we could interact with other cultures and societies based on these beliefs that had no evidence in the real world. And, you know, here we are looking at an example of that. And I started challenging people within my family and my friends, because I was scared at that point. I thought, this is dangerous. We're going down a bad path. And I could no longer hold on to that and behave as though I believed it. So that was a big stepping stone for me. And then in 2004, I started reading Michael Shermer and some of these skeptical writers. You know, came across Dawkins a few years later, and that pretty much nudged me over the edge.
So what's your take on religion? I mean, obviously you grew up in a very violent fundamentalist form. Are you able to understand, or do you consider people who say, well, my religion gives me comfort and strength and that sort of thing, or is it all sort of very... what's the word? Poisonous, do you find it?
Yeah, I have said over the years that I understand that. I remember listening to that gal from Utah who had been abducted. I can't remember her name now, but she was abducted when she was 14, and they found her a year later alive. And then she's being interviewed, and she talked about how she survived that because of her belief that if she never saw her family again on earth, she would see. So it was a comfort to her. And you know, these stories abound. But ultimately, the concern I have about religion comes down to, as long as people are willing to accept things on faith, if we're saying that that's the rules, that's the standards that we will establish for deciding what a truth is, then we're tacitly giving approval to these extremists, like the guys who flew into the World Trade Center, or groups like my father, who aren't necessarily... they haven't turned to violence yet, but they're destructive to their cultures and to their societies.
And you said in your talk today that Fred Phelps taught a consistent form of Christianity based on the Bible. What do you think this says about mainline Christianity that's not fundamentalist?
Yeah, see, that's a tough one, Ethan, because so many people will listen to their message and they'll come back and say, well, that's not my God.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm uncomfortable with that kind of response, because I think that most people, too many people, will sit in church and they will have someone tell them how it is, and then they walk away and that's what they believe. And if you look at the teachings of the Bible, if you look at what the Bible actually says, that's not sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people, like I said, they're either ignorant or they're deceiving themselves, because ignorance of what the Bible says is one thing, and people... I imagine many of them are. They don't know what it says. They don't understand that they're being inconsistent with the teachings of the Bible. Others do understand it, and they're being disingenuous to suggest that book doesn't justify the kind of theology that my father has come up with.
So shifting gears a bit, tell us a bit about your advocacy and activism of the LGBT movement.
Yeah, like so much of this came about not by design so much as the circumstances I found myself in. And I looked at, I look at the message that my family's putting out there, where they're being destructive in the society. And, you know, it's pretty obvious that the gay community is taking a beating from their theology. Now, you could argue on the one hand that they're one of the best examples. They've done more good for the gay community than bad because of how extreme they are. But the reality is I get emails and contact from a lot of people from the gay community who are suffering. They're struggling because of the message that they're putting out there. And it just seems like a natural fit for me to try to counter that message and to do something productive and positive for the gay community as a result of it. And it's been a wonderful experience going out and speaking and meeting the really diverse community of gay people in Canada and in the U.S. and realizing that so much, well, all of the mythology that you know, revolves around this question of gay rights is just nonsense. That these people are just like everyone else. They contribute to society just like everyone else. They have value. They have gifts. They have, you know, all of the same emotional issues that other people have. They contribute to society. It's nonsense for us to continue to treat them differently.
Excellent. And when did you decide to become an activist for skepticism and atheism and work for the Center for Inquiry?
Well, I actually came to Calgary in March of last year to talk, and circumstances conspired to give me the opportunity to actually move there within a few months. And when I came to talk, I actually talked to some of the founders and the leaders of that group there. And they had suggested the possibility. So I ended up having some conversations with Justin Trottier, the national director, and talked about it for a while with my fiance. And it is a steep learning curve for me, but it has been a remarkable opportunity to meet like-minded people and to try to leave some kind of a positive impression on this community.
And what can you tell us about skeptical activism in Calgary? What are the main battlegrounds that you address there?
Right now we're dealing with trying to disestablish the one school system.
Right.
Alberta, as you may know, is it's referred to as the Texas of the North. It is the by far the most conservative province in the country. And so it's a tough road to hoe, but there's a solid group of people there. We're dealing with issues like vaccination, trying to educate people on vaccination. We've been involved in the battle with homeopathy, dealing with gay rights there. I'm missing a few of them, but there's quite a few avenues that we're going down right now.
Well, one avenue that I did want to ask you about is the recent ban on fluoride in the water.
Yeah.
That was a tough one. You guys have any plans to maybe try to bring that back to the debate table?
Yeah, you know what? We didn't do anything about that, Ethan, and I kind of feel bad about it in retrospect. One of the problems that we have, which is a common problem in the skeptic community in general, is that on some of these issues there isn't there isn't a clear-cut agreement. And that's what we dealt with in Calgary, is that there were several within the group that thought, no, it's probably a good idea for us to let this thing abate and see what happens with it. So at this point, there are no plans to do anything other but, you know, wait and see and to gather the information when it becomes available about what the results are once they remove the fluoride. And if there's evidence, then we'll go after it then to try to get it reinstated.
So can you give us a bit of a heads up? Any events coming up for CFI Calgary that you can promote?
Well, we've got we generally have a speaker a month coming in. We're trying to get Richard Dawkins there. I'm starting to lose hope on that. I had a connection, and they were talking positively about getting him there. We'll see on that. We're also talking with a couple of organizers that have had experience in putting together larger events like the one we're at today. And we're looking to try to do, we've tentatively called it the Inquiry Expo, where we're going to try to put together a larger event once a year. So that's in the early stages. And I mentioned earlier about the vaccination issue. We're trying to get funding to put together a program where we will go to various communities in the Calgary area and invite individual citizens to come in and to ask their questions to experts. And we've got the guy from the Children's Hospital there who's the head of the Infectious Disease Department, who has agreed to go out there and address them one-on-one, because we think that we need to tackle this issue before this herd vaccination limit tips, and we end up with health problems in Canada. And if we can get this off the ground in Calgary, then maybe we can end up taking it to other communities across the country. So.
Excellent. Well, Nate, thank you again for joining us and telling us a bit about your story. Please join us again in the future.
My pleasure. Thanks very much, Ethan.
And we're back here on Radio Freethinker. So our thanks to Chris DiCarlo and Nate Phelps for talking with us in Kamloops. We're out of time, so let's go to our skeptical highlights. And I'm going to start things off with Skeptics in the Pub, Richmond, which is Thursday, May 26th at the Legends Pub, 7:30 p.m. Hopefully the Canucks will wrap things up tonight, but if they don't, we'll all watch the hockey game together.
Well, you know, and as some people I know are convinced that they might not win because the owners of the teams in a conspiracy amongst themselves in order to prolong the games and therefore make more money, have the fix in.
We'll have to keep our eye on that one. Also, one quick a skeptical highlight. We were going to talk about the case of Damon Fowler, a high school student in Bastrop, Louisiana, who received death threats and was disowned by his family because he stood up for his rights as an atheist. Don't have time for that story today, but please check out our blog, RadioFreethinker.com, to read about his situation. And do check out the Facebook page that's supporting Damon, as well as the Freedom From Religion Foundation and the Friendly Atheist, who has started a scholarship program to help Damon afford to go to college since he's been cut off financially by his parents.
And, you know, I think it's a very good issue to follow up on that, especially in the light of, one, persecution, and we often talk about free speech and hate crimes, and this strikes me as one of the reasons for those people who are against hate crimes to actually kind of support it, because this seems to be like he's being a victim just because of his particular beliefs. Speaking of being a victim of your beliefs, I'm going to mention that there's going to be a rally at the Vancouver Art Gallery, 2 p.m. on Saturday, May 28th. Stop Imperialist War and Occupation. It's sort of a regular thing organized by Mobilization Against War and Occupation, or Mao. They are protesting the occupation, as they see it, of Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, and Haiti, as well as calling for the end of the aggressive bombing of Libya. And anyone who listened today about the bombing and helicopter attacks on Tripoli, you go, well, maybe the defending the innocent has gone past that, and it's a bit more of an aggressive war. They're rather radical views, and they should be taken with a bit of salt, but you should participate anyhow if you support, if you're against war, occupation, that sort of thing. On a totally different note, in exactly the same vein, there's a lecture being put out, Is Torture an Appropriate Tool to Protect Society? It's presented by the Philosopher's Cafe. Should torture be reinstated as both a public policy and an investigative tool by democracies and dictatorships alike to maintain social order? That's a light topic. And should this trickle down to be used by parents and their teachers? Well, that would be
wow.
Fun. It's done by Zahad Makadoum, speaker, who writes extensively on justice, peace, and human rights issue, and is currently a public servant. It's 7:30 on Monday, May 30th, at Waves Coffee House, 1858 Commercial Drive. That's Commercial and Third, roughly. There is admission of $5. I don't think this is going to be like the Federalist Society. Philosopher's Cafe has a much more properly skeptic attitude.
Yep, sounds like it's going to be an interesting time.
So I hope you all show up for that. This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And this is Ethan saying thanks for listening, folks.